I think that at a macro level, if we want Bitcoin to go in the direction where most people are taking advantage of the self-sovereignty aspects that are available, then we need to continue to push the convenience forward so that, you know, it's easier and easier for people to feel confident that they can manage their own keys.
This episode of Empire, I sat down with Jameson Lopp, who is the co-founder and CTO of Casa. Most folks know Jameson for his pretty crazy story of getting swatted. For those who don't know what that means, the SWAT team literally showed up in his neighborhood and shut down the entire neighborhood. We got into that story and so much more on this episode. It was a long episode. I think you'll enjoy the entire thing. Jameson is probably the most well-known security and privacy expert in the space, but we talked about so much more, including why he holds such strong beliefs around this, what financial sovereignty really means, why you should care about your privacy and your security, even when it comes with the trade-off of convenience. So I loved this episode. I think you'll really enjoy it as well. After you listen, stick around. Let me know what you think of this episode. Shoot me a message on Twitter. And yeah, hope you enjoy the episode. I'll see you on the other side. This episode is brought to you by Luca Tax and Exodus. Stay tuned for more info. Jameson, thank you so much for joining. I sent out a tweet right before this saying I'm interviewing the legendary Lopp later today, and it's gotten quite the excitement. So you've built quite an audience, my friend.
Yeah, I don't really know how it happened because I've really been tweeting about whatever interests me for 11 years now. And even the first few years I was tweeting after I got hooked on to Bitcoin, basically nobody paid attention to me. So it's like the saying, you know, you can become an overnight success after like 10 years of hard work.
Yeah, we're seeing that right now with Beeple, right? Beeple's putting out art every day for 15 years, and now he's getting 69 million for it. When did you start tweeting, and when did you actually get this following?
Well, I mean, I know I joined Twitter in 2009, and I started getting interested in and tweeting about Bitcoin in 2012. And interestingly enough, my first Bitcoin tweet was actually about the first halving. Like, that was the first time I felt like something interesting has happened in Bitcoin. It's worth tweeting about. And at the time, I think I had maybe a couple hundred followers, and so I got like no retweets, no likes. But I've referenced it a few times since then, and now, you know, all the stats are jacked up on it because people have been wanting to like reference my 10-year-old tweet about the first halving.
That's amazing. We're gonna talk a ton about just private key management and Casa and your story and all of that kind of fun stuff that people requested and people wanted us to talk about. But I actually thought we could start somewhere different outside of crypto. You spent your early days in email marketing, kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, just kind of stripping away people's privacy from what I know about email marketing. Can you just talk about these days? And really what I'm curious about is if you could just share kind of your knowledge of like, how did that teach you about the trails of data that everybody's leaving behind?
Right. So, I mean, I spent the first 10 years of my career working at the same startup, though I changed jobs, I would say, every 18 months as that startup grew from 15 employees to 300 employees, from, you know, $1 million a year to tens of millions of dollar a year business. And it was actually kind of fortuitous at the time when I got out of school, was 2007, 2008, like the major economic correction was occurring, and a lot of people were having a tough time. It was actually a boon for the company that I joined, which was fairly random for me because I didn't care about email marketing. I was just looking for, you know, some sort of computer science related software engineering job. But what happened was all of these big companies, their marketing budgets got slashed. So they took that money out of more traditional print and billboard and radio marketing, which is very hard to track the ROI on. and instead started putting it into internet and email marketing, because all of a sudden you know exactly how much you're spending on marketing, and you can see how much money you're making from the marketing because you're tracking who's clicking on stuff and then who's going through the whole process of then buying something. And so what this came down to over the years is wanting greater and greater sophistication and controls over predictive analytics, and being able to say, okay, we've done all of these different campaigns in the past, and our marketing manager has tried all of these different things. Now, what can we learn from it in order to tweak our campaigns in the future so that more people buy more stuff? And so while, you know, none of this stuff interested me, like from the ideological standpoint, like I don't care who sells what to whatever, it fell upon me to use whatever tools were available to make these type of analytics and like predictive associative features possible. So like when we first started out, we were just using regular old MySQL database. That's fine for most things, but you get to a point where you're working with petabytes and petabytes of data. If you want to be able to manipulate that stuff in real time, you've got to use more cutting edge stuff. So that's where we start getting into the whole non-relational database, cloud computing, Google scale type cluster-based approach. It would get to the point where, you know, we were even, you know, looking at things like, we know this person is usually in this time zone and they open their emails in a cluster around this hours in the day, and so we want to be at the top of their inbox when they're like waking up or whenever they're usually looking at their email, and so we want to send it, you know, just a few minutes right before then. And so I mean, you can become sort of infinitely complex with this type of stuff, and it's all in the pursuit of making another buck, right? So it's all financially motivated. The system is in place there for people to devote as much as, you know, 99 cents per dollar of expected revenue coming back. Because if you're making a penny on any of these things that you're putting a lot of effort into, then you just multiply that by millions of automated actions, and you can see how, you know, you can basically create new revenue streams out of thin air from enough behavioral science, as it were.
It seems a bit funny, doesn't it, that some of the world's smartest people are, you know, in Silicon Valley working on making better customer relationship management platforms and optimizing the conversion rate to go from 5% on email marketing to 5.1%.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's worse than that. Of like, what are the smartest people working on these days? At least if it comes down to rational, financially motivated people who want to maximize their income, then I would say some of the smartest people are working on Wall Street or basically working at some sort of trading desk trying to eke fractions of a penny out of trades that happen, you know, millions of times a day, you know, playing zero-sum games that don't benefit society. They just benefit, you know, a small number of players that have the sophistication to find, you know, various arbitrage or other efficiency gains. Or, you know, a really sad thing for me ideologically is, you know, a lot of the smartest mathematicians, you know where they end up working? The NSA. The NSA is like one of the biggest hires of high-level mathematicians in the country. And I mean, obviously, we don't know everything that they're doing, but I suspect that there's probably more society-friendly type of things that they could be building rather than intelligence-based tools.
Yeah. Yeah, the smartest mathematicians, I feel like right now, are going to one of three places. They're going to trading, they're going to hedge funds, right? They're going to the NSA, or they're going and working on machine learning algorithms at places like Facebook, which all three of those don't seem like, you know, I don't know, ideologically too amazing of a place, at least for me personally. But I mean, what happened with you? Like, when you were at this email marketing firm, I mean, a lot of people who are going to be listening to this know you as the kind of very ideologically grounded in privacy and security. Did Bitcoin cause that for you, or and create that, or did you already have that kind of mindset back then?
I would say it definitely was a catalyst. I was interested in privacy and security, you know, tangentially, but I was not a hard practice what you preach type of advocate of these things. I cared about, I think privacy more from the aspect of not wanting government surveillance. I wasn't as against, I guess, a lot of the corporate for-profit surveillance stuff. Obviously, I was steeped in it. It did affect my own behavior in the sense that I knew how not only our system, but a lot of the other similar systems work. So, you know, obviously I was running everything with tons of ad blockers, and I knew not to click on things and emails because they were inevitably going to get tracked. Even to this day, I'm very studious about any time I get an unsolicited email, I immediately unsubscribe or mark it as spam, depending on like what options are available there. But it was, I would say, the biggest incentive for me to improve my privacy and security, direct results of Bitcoin, both from having to, you know, secure that data itself, and then from events happening later on that showed me that my privacy was terrible and I needed to fix it. But we had, you know, security incidents, and I think anyone who runs any type of online company that has some sort of cyber infrastructure is going to have to deal with it, because you're basically running a business that has a front door that anybody can come knock on. And so the security incidents that we had while I was at the email marketing company were generally around people wanting to get in and steal data, you know, steal email lists, steal personally identifiable information. Even though we told our clients you should not be storing any sensitive personal information in our system, we couldn't stop them. So there were plenty of times when we found clients that were storing things like credit cards or social security numbers. I mean, anything you can imagine. Even though we never made any claims about being a high security system, as soon as you open up an API that you allow people to put arbitrary data into, they're going to use it for the dumbest things because it makes sense to them. And so, data has value. It was a valuable asset in its own, in that, you know, if someone can steal, you know, millions of contact information, more detail about them that they have, the more valuable it is. You can always go sell that on the black market if you don't want to use it yourself for spamming or whatever.
So what does that actually mean for those who don't know, including myself? I've never sold data on the black market. How does that work?
Essentially, you go to a website. Usually it's going to be on the dark net, as it's known, aka Tor-based networks that provide much stronger privacy features for the people that are accessing and using these sites. And a lot of them are just simple forums. It's almost analogous to like over-the-counter trading type stuff, where you say, hey, I've got this information. You will probably provide a small snippet of the dump just sort of to prove its legitimacy. And then you say, you know, this is how much I want for it. And, before Bitcoin, I guess you would probably have to deal in either like mailing physical cash or using some sort of prepaid debit cards or something. Or you could, of course, if you're in the carding industry, you could just swap people's credit card numbers. and then get into sophisticated laundering schemes around that. But today you can just say, hey, I want, you know, half a Bitcoin for these 10 million contacts that are associated with this stuff, and that, you know, you could probably use to either scam them or steal their identities or who knows what.
All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break from the show, talk about two sponsors. You guys have heard them on the last two episodes. It's Luca Tax and Exodus. I wanted to re-record both of the ads, though, just because they're kind of two, one story and one update from one of the companies. So I just wanted to fill you guys in. The first one is Luca Tax. Luca, it's tax season right now, as some of you guys probably know. Taxes are so damn complicated that the IRS pushed back the deadline another month, so you guys, including me, could figure out our taxes. For folks in crypto, you guys know that crypto taxes can be an absolute nightmare. Fun little story, I tried having my accountant, this guy Josue, figure out how to do my taxes, and it was an absolute nightmare because of the crypto, right? A lot of us at least have crypto held on a few different platforms. I've got crypto on like Exodus, a few other places, and you know, you've got to deal with FIFO, you've got to deal with LIFO, there are exchanges, there are custodians, there are wallets, and what Luca Tax basically was able to do was, first off, super cheap, right? I had Josue go over to tax.luca.tech/empire, which is my URL. I get hooked up if you guys go over there and create an account. So do that. But I had Josue head over to Luca, and it just made it super easy for him to do my taxes. So you can have your accountant plug into Luca. You can do it yourself. But yeah, I highly recommend Luca if you guys are trying to do your crypto taxes this year. tax.luca.tech/empire. All right, head on over. All right, a lot of you know the second partner for the show is Exodus. About 20 or 30 people hit me up last time, said, is Exodus legit? Who is Exodus? How do you hear about Exodus? So I want to share a little background on that story. Basically, Exodus, a lot of people don't know them. They've been around since 2015. They have over 100 employees. They've raised a boatload of money, which we'll talk about in a second. And they're one of the best kept secrets in the space. Hardcore Bitcoiners, people who have been around since like 2012, 2013, love Exodus, because they basically let you manage your private keys, which is really sought after. If anyone's heard of, not your keys, not your crypto, Exodus allows you to basically do this. They've got super low fees when you're buying Bitcoin. You've got a built-in exchange. They let you plug into DeFi really easily. So they're an amazing wallet. When I first heard about Exodus, actually, our sales team had brought it to me and said, do you want to work with this company? I hit up Peter McCormick because I knew that they advertised with Pete. Pete said, yeah, they're super legit. I do a lot of my business banking with them. He basically gave his stamp of approval. I checked out the product, gorgeous UI, UX, really good security. So I'd really recommend it. They just raised $59 million in 4 days. Super impressive. So they're really well capitalized. And yeah, I'd recommend checking out Exodus. You can find them at exodus.com/empire. All right. Let me know what you think. So we're going to get into the kind of crypto and the Bitcoin rabbit hole in a second. But if I'm a listener who doesn't have much Bitcoin, and I'm kind of like, I understand that folks in Bitcoin, not your keys, not your crypto, like, they take privacy and security very seriously because it's a bearer asset. What about if I don't own any Bitcoin? Like, why should I care about data? You're really talking about a trade-off between privacy and convenience, right?
That's what all these things are. Whether you're talking about security or privacy, and I argue that security and privacy are kind of two sides of the same coin. I see privacy as kind of the outer layer of security. You know, if you can prevent someone from learning about you in the first place, then they can't attack you. And then the next layer is the actual security of, okay, someone is targeting you, they're trying to attack you, what do you have as safeguards in place that will slow down and hopefully completely stop the attack? Once we start talking about threat models, either for privacy or security, there's no such thing as, perfect privacy or perfect security. There's only the question of how much effort, what level of resources is going to be required by an attacker to pierce through whatever protections you have set up. So, ultimately, or at least the ultimate attacker is the nation state attacker. Generally, people do not have that in their threat model. Pretty much any privacy or security guides, unless you're just talking about straight up like communications security, which is totally possible to set up as being nation state attacker resistant. If we're talking about anything like physical privacy or physical security related, you probably do not have enough resources to defend against nation state that you're physically residing in that may have a nearly unlimited level of resources that they would be willing to use against you. So why should the average person care? Because an ounce of effort or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is that even if you don't use any of the Bitcoin or crypto related stuff, like I was saying before, data is valuable. You don't want to get your identity stolen, for example. So just making it more difficult for your credit card or your bank account or other important aspects of your identity to get stolen and sold and traded, that can save you innumerable hours of work trying to clean up after the fact. And I've heard stories of people who've had to spend years before they were able to like clean up their credit after an incident.
Yeah, that actually happened to a family member of mine. They got their kind of credit taken over, and it took them like two or three years to get that back. So
yeah, because I mean, usually you don't even notice for 6 months to a year.
That's
it's
exactly
not like people
happened.
Are pulling their credit reports every month.
Exactly. All right, so let's a lot of people know your story, but I think it would be helpful to just recap it. You clearly care about this stuff, and for good reason, right? Because you have one of the crazier stories that I've heard about a SWAT team showing up to your door. So let's take a little journey through history. Can you share what happened here?
Yeah, and I have all of the details in a long blog post that I wrote a few years ago. But the short version is that some random person, once my Twitter following had grown large enough, I encountered the problem that anyone with a large audience eventually encounters, just due to the law of large numbers, is there's going to be some deranged individuals out there who are willing to do things that other people are not. And so eventually I had an incident where someone who was sophisticated enough to cover his tracks, he basically used some throwaway services to place a phone call to my local police department and then claim he was me, give them my home address, and claim that I had killed people and was holding someone else hostage, and I had explosives in the house, and basically touch all of the like red flags that is going to result in the highest level of threat and therefore police response. And so naturally the police, even though they were suspicious of this for several reasons, because the call did not come into the local 911 number, came into a non-emergency number and got transferred, which is what all of these SWATter attackers have to do. And because they traced the call out of state, they also suspected it wasn't me. They were still probably, due to department protocol, they had to come in and shut down my entire neighborhood, block it all off, and figure out whether or not the threat was credible. So it was really weird how it worked out for me at the time, because I was actually not in my house. I was actually at the gym, and I was driving back to my house, and I encountered the police blockade. They wouldn't let me into my own neighborhood. And it took me a while of sitting outside the neighborhood to eventually figure out that they were there for me. And at that point, I got hooked up with the captain or the lieutenant who was like in charge of the operation, and went up into their mobile command center. And I was like, sorry about all of this. I was like, I already know what happened, and I can, because, I've heard of these things happening before in this space. And they offered to search my house, and I was like, no, I think I'm good. I'm feeling pretty safe.
How did you, How did you figure out that they were after you? Did you walk up and you said, what's going on here? And they said, we're looking for this guy, Jameson. And you said, I am Jameson.
Well, they didn't say my name, but you know, they said, we have a possibly armed individual. And I was like, okay, where? And then they were like, on this street. And I'm like, at this address? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, hi.
So can you explain that though, Jameson? Like, why does... So I get that this person's trying to screw with you and swatting, and I've heard it's happened to some other folks in the Bitcoin space as well. But why does that then give this person access to your Bitcoin? Or are they just screwing with you?
Yeah, it doesn't give them access to my Bitcoin. It's a form of extortion, because shortly after the police had packed up and left, I sent out a tweet that was basically jeering at the attacker, saying, you know, you're going to have to do better than that. And within an hour or two after I sent the jeering tweet, I got a direct call to my phone that I did not answer. I let it go to voicemail. I actually saved the voicemail. It's on the blog post that I eventually wrote. And it was basically another threat saying, it was asking. So in both the 911 call, he mentioned something about like around $50,000 ransom. And then once again, in the call to my voicemail, he demanded like $50,000 worth of Bitcoin. Otherwise, he was going to do something worse. And of course, nothing ever happened after that, because whoever did it is, you know, probably living in his mom's basement and making most of his money by doing various cyber crimes.
It's a crazy story. So, and just so everyone knows, you can find this article and a whole bunch of other articles at lop.net, I think it is. I've sent your website to probably over 100 people at this point who are trying to learn about Bitcoin. So if anyone's just getting into the space, or if you've been in the space for a while, you should go to lop.net. Let's see, Jameson, what happens after this? I'm assuming you're a, gun wielding, you know, kind of, you understand security better than most, but I'm assuming you got freaked out, right?
Yeah. Well, also, I remember when I was in the SWAT mobile headquarters, and they offered to search my house or to clear my house to make sure it was safe. I actually remembered that just the day or two prior, I had gone to the shooting range, and I still had like a dozen guns just laying out in my living room that I needed to clean after having taken them to the range. And I was like, oh shit, I definitely don't want to get into a situation where they're rolling up and, you know, I'm sure they could come up with a reason to like confiscate my guns or, you know, say something was wrong. And so, I started thinking about, you know, what is my threat model? And I went into a lot more detail in my blog post about this, but I approached it from a, you know, security analysis perspective of, you know, what has actually happened here? Well, you know, due to a combination of multiple events and changes in technology, but lack of changes in government and law enforcement protocols, we're in a situation now where someone with a modicum of sophistication can, for probably less than $10, create an anonymous phone call that then has the right trigger words, the right information, and can result in a disproportionate, you know, asymmetric level of response. The level of resources that got deployed in my neighborhood was, I would estimate, on the order of tens of thousands to maybe even $100,000 worth of resource. I mean, we're talking about dozens of officers, you know, the SWAT team, innumerable people in my community of 400 houses that were inconvenienced in one way or another. I mean, this just had a huge impact if we assume that the attacker probably only had to spend $10, $20, $30 actually, you know, setting up the technical pieces of the puzzle required to pull this off. And so how do you protect against that? Well, you know, there is no security level that I can implement that will keep a SWAT team away from my property if they know the address and they're targeting it. So you have to go one layer out. We need a level of privacy so that no one can feed the right information to your local law enforcement and trigger a response like this. And I went back and forth on some of the different options. I spoke to a lot of attorneys. We discussed things like, in some cases, I know that people have just gone the I'm going to trust law enforcement route, and they go to their local law enforcement and they say, look, this is me. This is my situation. I'm at high risk of being swatted. Please put me on a special list so that you like call me if you think, you know, call this number if you think that I'm like crazy and going to blow people up. But I don't trust law enforcement to, you know, follow an arbitrary whitelist exception like that. Like, I don't trust government. I don't trust bureaucracy. I can only imagine the number of ways that someone could screw that up, and that being a single point of failure that ends up not protecting me. So I chose not to go the, try to work with law enforcement route on all of this. And instead I said, okay, I'm going to use the other legal tools at my disposal to protect my privacy. And it became apparent very quickly that, you know, I'd been living in the same house for 10 years. I had given my address to hundreds, if not thousands, of different merchants and online services. And I knew that my name and address were associated in more databases scattered across the internet than I could possibly count. So there's no way I was going to clean all of that up. That meant the only option was to burn it all down and start all over. And so that's what I ended up doing. It took me almost a year. It cost me, I want to say, $30,000+ in legal fees. And of course, I had to sell all of my publicly registered possessions and purchase new things that were no longer owned by me, but rather owned by other legal entities that could not be directly tied to me. So this, you know, is the extreme level of privacy that it takes a lot of dedication, a lot of resources. Really, no one other than celebrities should ever have to do stuff like this. And I don't consider myself a celebrity. Like, I'm not like big headed. Rather, it's that I understand that now in the communications age, it's another type of asymmetry that can happen, where everyone knows about viral effects. Everyone is well aware that due to social media, someone who's a nobody can do one interesting, weird, creepy, whatever thing, and that can go viral. And that can result in them going from having a few hundred people paying attention to them, which is like their Dunbar number of friends and personal network that they're associated with, to having tens of millions of people paying attention to them the very next day. This, once again, is an extreme scenario. It's not going to happen to the vast majority of people, but you never know if you might win that lottery. And so the question comes down to, do you think it is worth the time, the effort, the resources for you to protect yourself against that particular edge case, because you might win the lottery in a number of different ways.
So crazy that you mentioned this. Yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of this tweet I sent out about coronavirus when it was just kicking off in early March. And the tweet went completely viral, got like 300,000 likes, 40 million people have viewed it. It was linked to in like CNN and all this shit. And I was ecstatic. I was like, I was getting all these followers and I was like, this is incredible. I went from like 5,000 followers to 20. And then my email I start to get pinged. People are hacking into my email. People are trying to break into my various bank accounts, crypto accounts, every social media account. And it was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare. And That's actually when one of my friends, I was kind of complaining about this, and he sent me your article, and he's like, you got to read Jameson's stuff. So I thank you for that. One more note on this burn it all down thing, and then we can start getting into Bitcoin a little bit, Jameson. When you burned it all down, how far did you go? Like, do your parents and friends know where you live? Do you use your same name? Or like, how far are we talking?
Yeah. So I really, you know, part of this, of course, was a direct response to a credible threat that I consider to be ongoing. But it was also somewhat of an experiment that I wanted to see how far I could take it. So, you know, I would say like the number of people who know like the actual address of my location at any given time is probably like 5. The vast majority of people and my family, friends, whatever, do not know my actual address. You know, even pretty much everybody in my family, they have mailing addresses. They don't have like my actual, you know, if I receive mail in my name at my location, then I know I've screwed up like that. But yeah, I also don't use my real name with like the actual people that I encounter in day-to-day life. You know, I have a couple different pseudonyms that I use for different things. I learned very quickly not to come up with a new pseudonym for every person that I met because that was untenable to keep track of. I'm also lucky that I'm not a celebrity. I think a lot of people who follow me just kind of assume that I must get recognized all the time. I've only ever gotten recognized once in real life, like outside of a Bitcoin conference. And that was in, I guess it was in Napa Valley. So, you know, it was near Silicon Valley. So I kind of consider that to be like, okay, nerd world. Otherwise, I just try to blend in and not do anything too Bitcoiny when I'm, you know, hanging out with other people.
So do you have friends in your town who call you by another name?
Yeah.
Fascinating. Do you get to pick? How did you pick the name? Are you like Dave or Tom, or did you pick some crazy name?
No, I mean, you know, when you're picking a pseudonym, it should be something that, you know, is average but not too average. So obviously you don't want to go with like John Doe, but I mean something along those lines that it matches your ethnicity, your geographic location, your gender. You know, it's you don't want to be too memorable.
Yeah. What are some I've heard you mention a book a few times that you might recommend here, but my question is like, so on one end of the spectrum you have what you did, which is, I don't think anyone's going to replicate who's listening to this podcast, I'll be honest with you. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have, there's the book for people who are watching on YouTube. You've got Extreme Privacy, What It Takes to Disappear.
Yeah. This is the book that I wish had existed when I undertook a lot of these efforts. And every time a new edition comes out, I learn a lot. So, you know, Michael Bazell is one of the premier privacy experts. And he's also got a podcast, so if you're into that,
interesting. And I think he also has a service where you can pay him like 6 figures and he'll take you off the grid.
Yeah I suspect that, you know, he primarily deals with actual celebrity clients who would rather spend a few a few hundred thousand dollars than have to put in all of the time that I did to like figure these things out myself. Yeah. And like, instead, that was, I do kind of, I mean, I like the idea of just paying someone like him to do it all, because the one thing that I did have problems with, even though I spent tens of thousands of dollars with attorneys and bankers and stuff, is that they screwed up multiple times. And, you know, I would start off at the very beginning, I gave them the whole spiel. I'm like, this is why we're doing this. This is why I need this privacy. I'm not a criminal who is trying to like hide any sort of ill-gotten activities or gains or whatever. And so they understood, but they were just so not used to it that there were multiple times that they would just be following a process and data would leak. And so, unless
they put your address on some piece of paper by accident because they're a lawyer and they're used to
it. Yeah, it would go into some database, and then I would get like a birthday card in the mail to my actual address, and I'm like, what the hell is this, people? Like, this, my name is not even supposed to be associated with this address. So, from that standpoint, using a privacy expert like Michael Bazell for him to act as a proxy, my understanding is like the way that he does it is like he doesn't even tell the other service providers, you know, what the name of his client is. And that's the only way that you can be 100% about any of this. Mm-hmm. And so my problem is that, you know, the banker and the attorney, they knew who I was because they were acting as my direct proxies. So, you know, whoever is acting as your proxy for a certain thing has to be airtight. And there's always going to be some level of trust there, unfortunately.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about data privacy and just security in general. But one thing I think that you're big on as well is just financial sovereignty. And mm-hmm. I think this could be a good segue into Bitcoin. What does Bitcoin mean to you in relation to all of this self-sovereignty and privacy and security?
Well, it's crude, but I think the best way that I've been able to describe Bitcoin is it's fuck you money. That sums up so much of self-sovereignty, of the way that I measure sovereignty, because this can be applied to many different aspects of your life. It's who can you tell to go fuck themselves, and you can only tell someone to go fuck themselves if they can't really do anything to harm you. So, you know, you're not going to lose anything by severing that relationship. So this is very hard to do when you're working with service providers that you're entrusting with very important things. So take a bank, for example. If you tell your bank, I'm not going to follow whatever your rules are, I'm not going to submit to, all this stupid paperwork, then they'll tell you, okay, we're going to close your account now. Goodbye. If you're going to tell like your grocery store or your other, food provider, I'm not going to follow by whatever rules you want, then they're going to say, okay, we don't have to sell you any food. So, if you want to be, self-sovereign from a food production standpoint, then you better have your own farm, your own sustainable setup in that term. Same thing for energy provider. There's so many different aspects of our lives that we're entrusting to third parties because this is how society has organized itself, and capitalism has found efficiencies, and that of course is through specialization. And so instead of us being like a mountain man who has to spend 90% of our day working on survival, and basically fulfilling the most basic level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we can instead work our way up that ladder by only focusing on tasks that are higher output. They're more economically efficient, and so we let other people specialize on these more base tasks where they can find more efficiencies there. But in general, the issue with creating more efficiencies in the system is efficiencies almost always create fragility. And it's the fragility that we're talking about being worried about when we talk about sovereignty, whether that's financial sovereignty, economic sovereignty, food sovereignty, energy sovereignty, whatever. It's trying to reverse that trend back into the other direction, where hopefully we can use some various aspects of technology so that we can have our cake and eat it too, so that we can not rely upon third parties, but also not have to spend 90% of our days focused on boring, mundane stuff, because humans are creative creatures. We want to be doing new, interesting things that are challenging.
Yeah. I take it you're a fan of the sovereign individual.
Absolutely. It was quite prescient, and I wish I had read it long before. I didn't read it until after I got into Bitcoin, but if I had read it before, then perhaps I would have joined up even earlier. Companies that become large enough, powerful enough, resourceful enough, are already able to and are taking advantage of a lot of the things that the sovereign individual thesis has, you know, around essentially negotiating with governments for preferential treatment or taxation or what have you. And, you know, the sovereign individual thesis is just kind of like, well, what happens if we take that all the way to the extreme and each individual is at the level where they can negotiate for favorable conditions from different governments? Now, that, I believe, is still going to be relegated to sort of the billionaire status level people. But hopefully, should things continue along the same track, it will continue to ratchet down, ratchet down, ratchet down, and become more available to a larger portion of the population.
Hmm. Let me ask your take on this then. Right now, I think it's 4% of all Bitcoin supply is held in corporate treasuries. You would know that stat better than me. That number might have changed.
I think it's around 6, but you know, it's probably even higher than that. That's like the only, that's just the ones that we know about.
Yeah. So you've got that. You also have a very small number of custodians hold the private keys to most of the Bitcoin, right? This is pretty antithetical to Bitcoin and just this sovereign individual thesis. What's your take on this? Is it good because more and more companies are buying Bitcoin and Bitcoin's getting adopted more, or is it bad, or it's a little bit of both?
I wouldn't go as far as to say it's antithetical to Bitcoin, because there's actually precedent going all the way back to 2009 where Hal Finney was postulating on some possible ways that Bitcoin could scale. And one of those ways was that the majority of Bitcoin would be held by banks and that, you know, it would really be more of a reserve asset and there would still be sort of banks with their own private ledgers that are getting updated behind the scenes. Now, obviously, that is not the way that a lot of us want to see it go. It's kind of been going that way, at least from the institutional standpoint. I think what it's not helped by some of the existing regulations that require for large funds, like really anyone who is managing, I think, more than a couple $100 million of other people's money has various regulatory requirements where they have to use a quote unquote qualified custodian. And that's what ends up pushing them to, you know, one of these large custodial providers. You know, hopefully that will change at some point. I'm not the legal expert, though. I'm not sure, you know, if anything is underway regarding that. There's also just the issue of even for like the large providers or even the high net worth individuals who they're not legally required to use a custodian. Due to the nature of Bitcoin, how new and confusing and complicated it can be, a lot of them probably feel safer just, once again, letting a third party with the expertise and the efficiency, the I would say focus on all of the minutia, you know, someone who lives, eats, and breathes the like security aspects of the space, to be worrying about that. They're, you know, they're willing to pay for that service because that gives them more peace of mind than them taking on the responsibility to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what I am actively fighting against. I'm kind of fighting against the tide of convenience. You know, as you mentioned at the very beginning, a lot of this is trade-offs between convenience and security. And so I think that at a macro level, if we want Bitcoin to go in the direction where most people are taking advantage of the self-sovereignty aspects that are available, then we need to continue to push the convenience forward so that, you know, it's easier and easier for people to feel confident that they can manage their own keys. That means we need to continue to improve user interfaces. We need to continue to learn from users, like what aspects of key management are scary, which aspects are foot guns, you know, how are people screwing up. Every time somebody screws up Bitcoin custody, we need to learn from it and improve our knowledge, our collective, you know, consciousness, and improve our technology of, like, how do we even let people, you know, interact with Bitcoin. So, there's also, I think, an argument to be made that the real power, the real value here is optionality. It's not that we should force people to hold their own keys. It's that the option should always be available, because that gives you some, you know, flexibility against systemic risk, and that, like, if the system starts collapsing, then at least hopefully some people will be able to get out into self-custody. But, you know, obviously it's better to be in self-custody in the first place so that you don't have to worry about running to the exits if something starts to go down.
How do you, let's talk about Casa for a second. It's one of my, just on a personal note, one of my favorite companies in the space. So if I am, what's kind of the spectrum of security in the crypto space? Like, on one end you have store your coins on an exchange, then you have store it with a BitGo or something like that, and then there's Ledger, and then there's Casa. Like, what's the spectrum for folks who might not be as familiar with security?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very large spectrum, because there's sort of, I guess you would say, almost like polymorphic number of combinations of different things you could mix and match for the security. So, you know, worst case scenario is you don't even own your own Bitcoin. You know, some other third party has the actual private keys, and all you really have is an IOU, and you can request that your Bitcoin gets transferred somewhere.
This is like a Robinhood or something like that.
Not even Robinhood, because they don't even let you withdraw, right? So I guess that would almost be
the worst.
But then, you know, like a Coinbase or exchange or whatever. So then you get into self-custody. The worst type of self-custody is what's called a hot wallet. So basically, you're using a piece of software that's running on a general purpose computing device, whether it's your laptop or your phone or whatever, and the actual private key is also on that device, which means that you have sensitive private material that is technically connected to the internet. So that means if somehow an attacker manages to walk through one of the front doors on your device and exploit something in any number of ways, then they could take that key and steal all your money. You have no recourse. Next step after that is taking your keys and putting them on a dedicated air-gapped device. This is where Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, so on and so forth come into play. This effectively protects you against most hacks. We've still seen some hacks in actual, like, software wallets, like MetaMask extension or whatever, where users, even though they had their keys on a Ledger, they were still tricked into sending it somewhere else. But that gets into other complexities of, like, Ethereum and all of that stuff. So you're like 99%, I would say, protected against hackers if you're using a dedicated hardware device, because it's doing independent verifications on non-internet connected hardware. After that is when you start getting into multi-sig, and you actually, instead of having one key on one device, you start having multiple keys on multiple devices. And now, even if one key gets lost, stolen, whatever, then you're fine. You can use the other keys to spend your money. And this is the level that Casa is operating at, where we're making it easy for you to get into a setup that is very diversified. You're using multiple different types of devices to store keys, You're storing them in different geographic locations, which gives you more robustness against loss from any number of different things. And you know, it's actually a fairly complex threat model. We've got like 30 pages of a threat model that are accessible on our website for you to understand like all the technical decisions that went into this. And so while it's, you know, it's a lot of technical decisions that went into the architecture, we slap a really nice user interface that guides people through the process. So this is really what we're trying to do, is take a decade of hard lessons that were learned through all types of different loss and build software that essentially acts as like a guide rail for people to follow the best practices without having to be a crazy obsessed Bitcoin nerd who spends all of their time reading about best practices and hacks and thefts and stuff. Hmm.
I know several close friends who use Casa, and unfortunately they only started using Casa once something pretty bad happened to them. So just to make sure I understand how Casa works, and to make sure everyone understands how Casa works, let me try to repeat it back to you. So basically, you might need, in this lockbox analogy, you might need 3 keys to unlock the lockbox. You're going to give the user, let's say, 5 keys. Casa holds on to a key. You send a key to, you know, a storage box held in a safe. I get a key, and 2 other keys go out somewhere. If 2 of those keys get lost, you're fine because you still have the other 3 keys. No single key can, if you only have 1 key, so say someone hacks me and gets one of my private keys, I can't unlock that lockbox. Is that a general understanding of it?
Exactly. And we make it very easy to replace keys in the app. You know, if you have a device that gets lost or you think it might have been compromised, it's very easy in our app to mark it as compromised and then go get a new device, add that to your key set, and then basically perform a key rotation so that you're kind of like rotating your funds out of that old key set and into the new key set.
Are most of your customers individuals, or are they, is it more of a B2B sale?
No, it's definitely individuals. That's, we originally in 2018, we kind of took a Tesla model, like starting premium and working our way down. So we started off really only targeting high net worth individual, like OG Bitcoiner types. And then, over the years, we've added a few other tiers with, less white glove service, I think, is the best way to describe it. So, yeah, we've got a very simple $10 a month type of tier, which is really a self-service setup. You bring your own hardware, plug it in, easy to get going, but only really offer email support. And then at our higher tiers, you'll get more complex setups, but also these tend to require more handholding, and so you'll get higher levels of like phone and video call support, all the way up to our top tier, which we have a specialized inheritance program, which is really onerous to get set up because we actually onboard your estate attorney as a key holder into your key set.
Wow, that's amazing. In terms of, we're going to start to wrap this up. I have one question that's non-security related. You've been in this space for a long time. You clearly like the data side of things. Most people in the space look at the exchange rate, right, of Bitcoin to US dollars. But exchange rate is just one pretty simple metric that we can observe. Actually, one of the less quality, in my opinion, metrics that we can use to observe the evolution of the space. What are some metrics that you pay attention to, and what metrics right now excite you?
Well, I have an annual post that I do that goes through all of the metrics that I pay attention to. It's basically my annual recap. There's probably 100 different metrics in there. And of course, my first ever project was a fork of Bitcoin Core called Statoshi, which is it's just metrics of Bitcoin nodes. And anyone who goes to statoshi.info can see some eye candy charts of what my Bitcoin node is doing right now. But I'm tracking things like sustainability. One thing that's been coming up more recently is, how does the Bitcoin network continue to pay for its thermodynamic stability as the block reward keeps going down? We like to see transaction fees continue to offset the decreasing subsidy. But, there's just a lot of aspects of Bitcoin that are not hard and fast science of, from a thermodynamic security standpoint, Bitcoin could work at any level. It'll automatically adjust to whatever amount of energy is put into it by miners. So it's hard to say how much is enough. I did see one person on Twitter said it just needs to be higher than the energy output from the biggest nation state, and that should be enough to be safe, which I thought was an interesting point. But I also like to look at adoption of like Lightning Network, what are the number of nodes and amount of Bitcoin that we can tell is locked up in there. It's not all even publicly available, so some of these things are fairly rough estimates. Seeing things like adoption of various aspects of Bitcoin, like SegWit, which it looks like has been adopted by almost everyone, except for blockchain.com. just like continuing to see how the network moves forward and evolves. I also do annual tests of Bitcoin node performance, and it's interesting to me because I'm often surprised year after year where I expect the sync time from Genesis to blockchain tip for a fully validating node to increase, because of course we're adding like another 50 gigabytes or so of data that need to be downloaded and verified. And actually, with a number of node implementations, it actually keeps going down year over year because of the various optimizations that they keep making at very low levels. So, there's no one thing, but I would say that like price is the least interesting to me. I believe that price is only interesting as a sort of lagging indicator for how ignorant the world is about Bitcoin.
Well said. This was an audience question that at GorillaV2 asked on Twitter. When will you be able to run your own node with your multi-sig setup? So when will, yeah.
Well, in terms of Casa, connecting to your own node from the Casa app has been something people have asked about us for a while. If we did end up doing that, it would probably only be against an Electrum node, because we spent a lot of time actually swapping out our infrastructure last year. We wrote a whole post about that, about Electrum performance. So we're already using Electrum on the back end at Casa. But there is kind of a workaround for it, and we have some blog posts and knowledge articles about how part of the process for Casa is us proving to the user that Casa as a company is not a single point of failure, and that includes Casa itself. So part of getting set up with a multi-sig wallet in Casa is actually us providing you with instructions and data for how to recover your funds using other software that supports the same standards as Casa, and these very common multi-sig standards. And as a result, you can go recreate your wallet in Electrum or in Spectre Desktop. We have specific instructions for both of those. The nice thing about Spectre Desktop, which I just wrote a blog post about, I think a month or so ago, is that Spectre Desktop actually requires you to be running your own node, and it connects to that. So what you can do is you can essentially recreate your Casa wallet as a watch-only Spectre wallet and ensure that any of the data that is appearing in Casa is actually being fully validated by you and your full node. And this helps keep Casa honest as well. It protects against other edge case things. Like if you suspected that Casa might be screwing with the multi-sig and like changing the keys in there, then the neat thing about the way that Bitcoin addresses work is that they're based on a hash of the redeem script. The redeem script is essentially the Bitcoin language that describes all of the conditions for what is required to spend that Bitcoin. And since the Bitcoin address is a hash of all of that, if you change a single byte of any of those spending conditions, it results in a completely different Bitcoin address. So by you know, cross-checking the Bitcoin addresses in your own watch-only wallet versus what Casa is telling you, you can actually independently validate and ensure that we are not screwing around with any of the aspects of your Bitcoin HODL.
Very interesting. We're going to wrap it up with two questions here, and then you can, if you'd like to, you can ask me one question to finish this. But my first question is just, we talked a lot about security and privacy and financial sovereignty and custody. We didn't talk that much about just you as a founder and building Casa. And it's not easy to build a company, right? It's pretty damn tough. What is the biggest challenge that you're going through as an entrepreneur and as a founder right now?
Well, right now is actually a good time because it's a bull market. This is my second cycle, my second Bitcoin cycle, you know, working full time in the space. And interestingly enough, I actually joined BitGo right at the beginning of the last bull cycle, like early 2015, you know, after the Gox crashed, basically bottomed out. And so it was like, it was a good 2 years of bear market, slow going during that time until the scaling wars really heated up. And then I started Casa right after the last crash. It was early 2018. And so, you know, had 2.5, almost 3 years of bear market with Casa. And it was slow going because really the only people who are around in a bear market are the hardcore believers, usually who have been in it for a while. So, you know, it's hard to grow because the ecosystem at a macro level is not growing. You're kind of searching for scraps. You know, that's one of the reasons why we tried diversifying from the multi-sig to also having the node product to try to, you know, increase our like total self-sovereignty package and pull in more Bitcoiners. You know, that ended up not working for a multitude of reasons, including the fact that just the total addressable market size for node owners is actually far smaller than for self-custody. And, you know, I would say like one of the hardest things that we had to do was actually cut that product. It upset a lot of people. It upset us. You know, it upset having to let team members go who had been working on it. But you know, ultimately, it was the right decision, and we came out the other side doing well. You know, there are multiple other companies in the space who also had to cut node products. You know, this was, I think, not a unique one-off thing. But just more indicative of, you know, trying to sell nodes in general. Fundraising, this is the first time I ever did anything with fundraising, and that is totally not my jam. If I never have to fundraise again, it'll be too soon. I'm a technical guy. I want to be reading, writing, reviewing code, you know, doing the occasional shitpost on Twitter, but you know, talking to venture capitalists and trying to convince them that, you know, like my business is the best business is definitely not the way that I roll, because I'm more of the fuck you, I'm building something because it's cool, rather than you know, this is going to be a $1 billion company. You know, the reason that I actually switched from BitGo to Casa, well, one of the reasons, but I would say one of the primary reasons, was that despite me being a Bitcoin security expert with years of experience, I found myself spending an entire weekend every year refreshing my cold storage. And I was like, well, if it's this painful for me, I can only imagine, you know, other people, and most people are just not gonna want to go through all this trouble. So it was less of me being like, oh, this is a business opportunity right here. It was more of, this is a requirement if we want Bitcoin to go mainstream. We need to build products that make normal people feel comfortable doing secure Bitcoin operations. So for me, it was more of an investment in Bitcoin, the system, as a high level of like, what is the next greatest impact and contribution that I can have to the system? Because I'm not a cryptographer. I'm not even a protocol developer. I have like a few minor trivial commits to Bitcoin Core, mostly as a result of my Satoshi fork and just things that I ran into. But that's just not my thing. I'm a like application infrastructure type of engineer. And I think that the most leverage that I can apply will be making contributions at that level.
What was your least favorite meeting with a VC?
Well, you know, there were a few of them. You know, we talked to a bunch of crypto VCs. We also talked to a bunch of regular VCs. I mean, the worst ones, there were a couple where they were obviously just like Bitcoin skeptics. And I'm like, you know, what the fuck am I even doing here? I was like,
you're not here to convince me about Bitcoin. So,
yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm supposed to convince you not only that my business is good, but ultimately I have to convince you that Bitcoin is also going to be an amazing thing. It's like, I'm not up for that. If you don't believe in the mission that I am trying to follow, then I don't need your money. Like, I want someone who is willing not just to give me money, but also to support the business in a variety of other ways. And that means you need to believe in the business.
Yeah. What is, last question here, just be, what is something that folks don't know about Jameson, or that folks don't know about Casa, that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Well, I mean, I still think the biggest misconception is that like Casa is, well, a lot of people still think Casa is a node company, or that we started out as a node company. We actually started with multi-sig. Probably at an even higher level, the bigger misconception is that Casa is a Bitcoin company. And it's not that we support anything other than Bitcoin, or even that we plan on adding support for anything else in the near term. But rather, Casa's mission is to be a personal sovereignty company. You know, that was the mission that drove us to go down the route of adding the node a couple of years ago. But what this means is that whenever there is a way for us to help people use cryptography and technology and private keys, really anything that people can use to leverage their own sovereignty, that we can, as technologists and as, you know, like customer client services, can help them, you know, navigate, if that will empower our users and we can provide like a better user experience than the current level of tooling around whatever these technologies are, and we can package those all together, that is what Casa is going to do.
Amazing. Love that. Take it or leave it. We can wrap this up with one question for me if you'd like.
Well, kind of going back to your own personal incident, are you ready to burn it all down, and what are you willing to commit?
I am not ready to burn it all down. I'll be honest with you. I tried burning it all down, actually. And, I didn't try burning it all down. That's not an honest thing. I tried really going towards your end of the spectrum, and then I took a trip to Portugal, and I was trying to navigate Portugal. I was refusing to use Google Maps, and I was trying to navigate Lisbon, Portugal with this like printed out map, and I got so frustrated. I was in these weaving in and out little roads, and
GPS devices in that type of setup can be wonky.
They are, yeah, but what's really wonky is these printed out maps from the 1990s. And I just said, you know what? This is literally, I'm living right now the trade-off between convenience and privacy. And I wanted privacy, but in this moment, it's hot as hell and I'm lost and I want convenience. And I slipped up, I'll admit it. And so that was kind of a setback. I will say that I really encourage people to go beyond just, I think the obvious one is kind of just 2FA, turn on 2FA for like security, but there's so many layers that they can go beyond that. And it's what you said at the very beginning of this conversation, which is just spending, I think you said like an ounce for a pound or whatever it is, really just spend a weekend doing this stuff, and your security and your privacy can increase by 95%, right? That extra 5% is going to, could take months or weeks and a lot of money to get to, but just spend 2 days to just reassess your privacy and your security, and it'll go a really long way.
So yeah, it doesn't have to be full bore 100% going off into the mountains at once, right? Is that privacy can be an incremental thing, security can be an incremental thing. I mean, it's just kind of like personal fitness as well. It's like you don't have to go to the gym and start benching 400 pounds. You can start slow and work your way up.
Exactly. Jameson, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Everybody can check out Casa. You're obviously on Twitter at LOPP at LOP. Folks should also check out LOPP.net, LOPP.net. Anything else you want to share with the audience?
No, that's enough to keep people busy. I would say there's at least like 6 months worth of educational resources on my website if you're looking to go further down the Bitcoin rabbit hole.
Totally. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks, Jameson.
Thank you.
That was Jameson Lopp. Unbelievable episode. Head over to lopp.net if you want to learn more about him. He's also at Lopp on Twitter. As always, go to our website, blockworks.co/newsletter. Subscribe to the newsletter if you enjoy this type of content. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, or really wherever else you get your podcasts. I think we're at, 40 or 50 reviews so far. We need to get to 100 reviews, and Apple told me they'll consider putting us on the homepage of Apple. So yeah, head on over to Apple, give us a 5-star review, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Empire.